We are looking here as we're concluding this spring. I had no intention of taking this long to go through the Old Testament, but it's worthwhile, I think. Turn over to Daniel 9, where we're looking at the 70 weeks of Daniel. Now, I have tried over the last few weeks to kind of get us started on the 70 weeks of Daniel. Part of the reason I am taking so long is because I genuinely want you to see this. Let me put it this way. How many of you are familiar with the Battle of Gettysburg? Do you know why the Battle of Gettysburg was important? It was probably the most important battle in the Civil War. It didn't end the war. The battle was in 1863. The war didn't end for another year and a half or so. But it was a turning point in the war. It was the first time that the South invaded the North. And if the North had lost that, Washington would have been in danger, Washington, D.C. It was a three-day battle. It was a strategically critical battle for both sides. If I could put it this way, Daniel 9, from the standpoint of eschatology, is Gettysburg. It's where you either see it or you don't. It's where, if I can put it this way, and I hate to use the word dispensationalism because it has all kinds of connotations I don't intend, but it's where dispensationalism stands or falls here. There are two things, and this is why I have camped out in the Old Testament. Because if you don't get this, when you come to the New Testament, you'll be confused. I have never read, well, I don't want to be arrogant. I won't say that. But let me just say this way. There are two things you must understand if you will understand eschatology in the New Testament. And if you miss these, it will be confusing. It will be, you will feel lost in the New Testament. Nothing works out. And they are these two things. The distinction between Israel and the church, and the prophecy of the 70 weeks. And what I've been trying to do is to put those together for you, and that's what I'm trying to do. So I want to give you tonight, more than anything, I'm not going to really, I don't even know if I'm going to get to these notes that you have in your hand. But what I want you to understand, what I've been trying to show you, and I'm going to try to show you again tonight, is this. The prophecy of the 70 weeks is related to the kingdom that the Jews were looking for. In other words, the Jews were looking for this kingdom that would come, the Messiah would come, he would reign on the earth, he would bring righteousness, he would destroy the nations. Okay, this is all in the book of Daniel, but it's all throughout the Old Testament, and particularly the prophets. He was going to destroy the nations, he was going to purify Israel, he was going to bring in the kingdom. Daniel is the only prophet that deals with time. And what I'm trying to point you to is the fact that the 70 weeks, the ending of the 70 weeks, corresponds with everything in Daniel that relates to time. Everything is pointing to one point, the point when the rock or the stone destroys the statue, the point when the little horn is destroyed by the Messiah in Daniel 7, the end of the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel several times in chapter 12. All of these things are pointing to one thing. That point where the kingdom comes in. Where the Messiah comes, destroys the nations, and sets up his kingdom. And what I'm trying to show you is that Daniel 70 weeks, the end of that, corresponds with that timing. And what I was trying to show you last week is, and tried to show by evidence, I think it's clear when you take it in the context of Daniel and in the context of the Old Testament, that the purpose statements given in verse 24 are related to that kingdom and have not been fulfilled. They relate to Israel, not the church. They relate to the taking away of sin from Israel. They relate to the righteousness entering Israel. That is what the Old Testament is looking toward. So if you look at verse 24, it says, 70 weeks have been determined, decreed for your people and your holy city. That's just what Daniel has been praying about all of chapter 9. He's been praying about Jerusalem, the sanctuary, and his people. And he's been confessing their sin, and he's asking, when is the desolation of Jerusalem going to be finished? And because of what he read in Jeremiah, he thought it was going to be at the end of the 70 years, which is about up. And so he was looking for the coming of the kingdom at the end of that, for good reasons. And the angel corrected him and said, no, there's another 77s decreed on the people of Israel, on your people and your city. And then he says, he gives six things that are going to happen in that time. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Now, I'm not going to go over what I went over last week, but I would argue that none of those things took place at the cross. None of those things have happened yet. If you look at them in the context of Daniel, and you look at them in the context of the Old Testament, they're clearly future. It's the day of the Lord. And what I'm trying to show you is that these 70 weeks come to conclusion when Christ returns. They're not his first coming, they're his second coming. Now, I want to emphasize the importance of this. And if there's one thing I want to get across tonight, it is the absolute centrality of this if you're going to understand eschatology. I don't want you to accept this because I said so. And that's how eschatology is taught today. A lot of people say, well, my pastor believes that. I don't want you to believe it because I believe it. I want you to see it. That's why I'm camping out here. Because I'm not, the more I've studied this, the more I read all sides of this argument, the clearer it gets. I'm not ashamed of what I believe about this subject. This is clear. And I want you to see it. It's not easy. It's not simple. But the more you study it, if you see it, you see it. And if you see it, you understand it. And everything comes together. Now, I want to explain, first of all, and this is where I don't know how long it's going to take. This isn't in your notes. But I want to explain the dilemma. Okay? And some of this is kind of review, and that's okay because I'm trying to get this to kind of gradually sink in. That's why I'm not trying to do this in 1 or 2 weeks. And so what I want to do is I want to look at the numbers and maybe preface this. Again, sounding a little too assured, do you remember this? You remember when I did that in hermeneutics? Okay. This is what's going on here with all millennialists in this passage. You remember how they did that? This was a Ball and Paul Kettle video, and the guy was explaining why 14 times 5 is 25. And he goes, look, 14 times 5 is 25. 4 times 5 is 20. 5 times 1 is 5. 25. And then he did it with addition. Then he was 14 plus 14 plus 14 plus 14 plus 14. He said, look, 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. Now, if you know the principles of math, you know 14 times 5 isn't 25. But what I'm trying to point out is that the issue here in the 70 weeks is the numbers. If I can put it this way, I'm going to try to explain this, but I want to put it this way. If you will talk about Daniel and Revelation to covenant theologians, the very first thing they will tell you is the numbers don't mean the numbers. That's where they almost always begin when they talk about millennialism or when they talk about Daniel and Revelation. And the reason is the numbers don't work. They don't. It's that simple. They don't. And rather than give up their system, they just say the numbers don't mean numbers. And that's what they do. They say numbers, and they'll always say this. They'll say, the numbers are symbolic. Now I want to be the first to admit, I don't have a problem with calling numbers symbolic. And I've said this before, but I want to make this clear. If I say to you, Jesus was in the wilderness for 40 days, I would say the number 40 is symbolic. It is. Symbolic of suffering, trial. The Jews wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. That's a symbolic number. It doesn't change the fact that they were, in fact, in the land or in the wilderness for 40 years. It doesn't mean they were, you can say they were in the land for 90 years or some indefinite period of time. The fact that numbers may be symbolic doesn't change the fact that they're numbers and that they mean what they mean. So let me explain to you the dilemma. And then I'll explain to you how the dispensationalists, for lack of a better term, resolve the dilemma and why they don't like the resolution to the dilemma. Okay? If you look at verse 24, the total number is literally, and again, in the Hebrew, it's literally sevens 70. And I'm not going to go through again. I pointed out last time, I tried to show that the sevens, which is translated weeks in most translations, it's literally sevens. It's often translated weeks in the Hebrew. The word, or the, when you look at the context of Jeremiah's prophecy, which was based on the, which was 70 years, and the fact that it was talking about sabbatical years, which are sevens, makes it logical that it's 7 years. In other words, when it says 70 sevens are decreed upon your people, it's talking about 490 years. Okay? Now that makes total sense because they were in the land for 70 years, right? They were in Babylon for 70 years. Why were they in Babylon for 70 years? Why did God say 70 years? Yeah, for every sabbatical they missed, there was a year. Well, if you'd figure that out, how long is 70 years times 7 years? They were in captivity for 70 years because of 490 years worth of missing a sabbatical year. So the point is, there's every reason in the world to take it as years. Okay? Now, that number is then divided up. Now, again, I will go through this in more detail. Because, again, I want you to see it. But rather than get lost in the details, I want you to see the overview of the issue and the problem. And then we'll talk about the details of the text and the words. Okay? If you look at verse 25, it says, "So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be seven..." Now, by the way, the ESV totally messes this up, but the other translations, by and large, are true to Hebrew. It says, "Unto Messiah the Prince there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of desire and of distress." In the Hebrew, all the numbers are next to each other. Okay, what I mean by that is this. It says literally, let me look. It says literally, "You are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince," it says seven sevens and 62 sevens. In other words, it's all together in the Hebrew. The ESV, if you have the ESV, separates them. And it puts the first seven sevens with the first phrase and the second with the last. There's no reason to do that. The idea is this, that from the issuing of this decree to the coming of the Messiah would be seven sevens and 62 sevens, which equals 69. Okay? Now, if you multiply this out, by the way, you get 483. Okay? So 483 years. Now, we'll look at this in the future. There are three potential decrees, technically. There's only one decree to rebuild the city. There were two in regard to the temple. There was one regarding the city and its walls. It was the one given by Artaxerxes to Nehemiah in 444 BC. And that's the one that I would argue for, but I'll talk about that later. But the point is this. There is a starting point with a number of years, and it's the ending point is the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah. And then, notice, in verse 26, then, after, and it's very important in the Hebrew, the article is here. It's not after 62 years, but after the 62 years, which would make it include the seven. It says, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Now, everybody agrees that's the crucifixion. Okay, if there's one thing that everyone agrees on, that's it. Everyone agrees this is talking about the Messiah being cut off, that is being crucified, after the 69th week. It doesn't give a time. How long after, it simply says after. So everyone agrees, who would be, you know, believes in inspiration, argues, would agree that the 69 weeks ends just before Christ's death. Okay? But now here's where the challenge is. And without question, the language in verse 26 and 27 is difficult. It says, then after 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who's to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. By the way, just about everyone agrees that's AD 70. That's when the Romans came in and destroyed the city. That's what Jesus was talking about when he said, there is coming a day when there will not be one stone left upon another. He's referring to the same thing, AD 70, when the Romans would come under Titus and destroy the city and the temple. Everyone agrees with that as well. And its end, meaning Jerusalem's end, will come with a flood. Even to the end there will be war, desolations are determined. Now verse 27 is the last week. What is called the 70th week of Daniel. And here's what it says. And now there's a lot of controversy over who the he is. And we'll talk about it in the future, but it says, and he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Now, let me explain it this way. This prophecy has caused more, what's the word? Theories and calculations and trying to figure out probably than any other passage in the Bible. As many commentators as you can think of, there are theories on what the 70th week is. The problem is this. If you bring Jesus, if you bring the 69th week down to almost any period around Jesus, it doesn't matter what you do. There are some, I just read one on the internet not too long ago that tried to bring it down to the birth of Christ in 5 BC or 6 BC. Many of them will try to bring it to, and I don't agree with this, but many will try to bring it down, they'll start with a different decree, they'll bring it down to 26 AD and say it was the baptism of Jesus. Okay? There are some who try to bring it somehow to the crucifixion. I would argue, and I'll explain this and probably next week, but maybe today, I would argue that it falls on the triumphal entry. I think it's kind of interesting. But no matter where you put it, and everyone agrees it falls before the crucifixion, and it obviously has to be within the life of Christ, because it's referring to Christ. No matter where you put it, add seven, and it doesn't work. Nothing's there. Add seven, and it doesn't work. If you go to 6 BC, add seven, nothing there. You go to the baptism of Christ, you add 7 years, nothing there. You go to the crucifixion in 30 AD or 33 AD, wherever you want, those are the two dates generally that people use. There's nothing there. Add seven. Where do you go? You get to 39 BC or 35 BC. There's nothing there. Nothing that is stated here has happened. Who made a covenant? The covenant theologians try to make this Christ. When did Christ confirm or make a covenant? They read the covenant, the grace, covenant of grace into this, and they say he confirmed that covenant. But where did Christ make or confirm a covenant for 7 years and then break it in the middle? It's not there. Nothing happened in 7 years. Nothing for anybody. And commentators, for the longest time, just had all kinds of wild theories about what happened to the 7 years. Where is it? And commentators like the famous Hengstenberg, who was a phenomenal Old Testament commentator from the Old Testament or from the 19th century, Delitzsch, Kylan Delitzsch. Some of these, I mean, they really wrestled with this because they wanted to maintain the literalness of the years, and they couldn't. And they have all these quotes frustrated. There's no answer to this dilemma. Well, there was a, and I'm not sure I'm not sure of the full history of it, but probably the most famous, and certainly the one that kind of turned the tide, was a guy named Sir Robert Anderson, who I'm not sure when he wrote the book, but he died in 1918. He was Plymouth Brethren. He was certainly in connection with like Darby and some of the founders of dispensationalism, without question. He had a relationship with them. But at any rate, he figured out that he mathematically figured out that the 69 weeks came right down to the entering in. The triumphal entry. That was a major point because it verified that these are literal years. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But the point is this: what the dispensationalists did, and when you see this, it makes total sense. Okay. What the dispensationalists did is said this: there's a gap. That's all they did. In other words, it's not a continuous 70 weeks. There is a gap between 69 and 70. Now, once you see that, it's kind of obvious. And it is. Now, they will attack this. I have read their arguments. There really aren't any good arguments. They will attack this to the end, because if you acknowledge a gap, you acknowledge the realistic dispensational interpretation. So they will fight tooth and nail against the gap. They have nothing to replace it. They have nothing else. There is nothing that has happened. Their only other response is to say the numbers don't mean the numbers. That's the only thing they can do. But notice, there is a gap. There's a gap in the text. Verse 26. After the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Which I think, when he says have nothing, is talking about the fact that he didn't get the kingdom. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and sanctuary. That's 70 AD. Now, he doesn't say, you would expect him to say, in the 70th week. He doesn't. He says after the 69th week, and then the 70th week doesn't begin until verse 27. Now, we'll talk about this in some detail when we get down to verse 27, but my point is this. If you don't have a gap, it doesn't work. You have to resort to the fact that the numbers don't mean the numbers. Because nothing happens 7 years after. Nothing, no matter where you go. Now, to further this, and again, this isn't like advanced math, okay, but to further prove that this is still future, and I think I've already done this, I'm going to do it again, I want you to see it, I want you to understand why this is such a clear conviction with me. Because the Bible, it's so, when you see it, you see it. It just comes together. There's no manipulation of numbers. If you look at verse 27, it says, but in the middle of the week. Now, again, I'm not a mathematician, but 7 divided by 2 is 3.5. Is it like coincidental that that's how long the little horn persecutes the people of God? Look back at chapter 7. Again, I know we've looked at this, but I just want to reiterate it. This is the horn that came out of the last kingdom. This is the horn that the Messiah destroys in chapter 7 when he comes. He says in verse 24, as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them. That's the little horn. And he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. That's 3.5 years. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. That is absolutely coincident with the rock being thrown at the image and destroying the image. And then, verse 27, then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdom under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. So that the point is this, that in Daniel, the 3.5 year reign of this little horn, okay, is destroyed by the Messiah when he takes the kingdom. Now the problem that all millennialists have is when you get to the book of Revelation, no matter where you date the book of Revelation, the little horn is there as future. And not only is he there as future, the 10 kings are mentioned in Revelation 17:12. Not only is all this mentioned there as long after Christ came, but not only that, it's the little horn that's destroyed in chapter 19 when Christ returns. That's when the kingdom comes. And lo and behold, is it a surprise in chapter 20 of Revelation after Christ returns, that's when the kingdom is set up? It's consistent with the Old Testament. There's nothing new. It's not. Listen, it's simple math. 3.5, 7. Now, if you say, well, what is the 3.5? And they try to say, well, it doesn't mean literally 3.5 years. But the same number is given in Revelation. Revelation chapter 11. Leave out, this is verse 2, leave out the court which is outside the temple and do not measure it, for it has been given to the nations. And they will tread underfoot the holy city for how long? 42 months. 42 months just happens to be exactly 3.5 years. Now, why is that significant? Because you understand, if you go back to Revelation chapter 9, verse 27, what happens in the middle of the week? Notice. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abomination will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction. The point is this, and I'll go through this wording in detail in the future, but my point is this. What happens in the middle of that week is the little horn turns on Israel, stops sacrifice in the temple, and sets up an abomination of desolation, which is talked about in Revelation 13. That abomination of desolation lasts for 3.5 years. That's how long it says the Gentiles are going to tread under feet the holy city. The holy city is Jerusalem. Now, you understand the significance of what I'm saying. If what I'm saying is true, it proves several things. Number one, it proves that God still has a future for the nation of Israel. Number two, it proves that there will be a temple rebuilt in Jerusalem. And number three, it proves that the millennium is still future and that it will be on the earth. It proves everything I've said in the Old Testament about the kingdom. In other words, the kingdom that God promised the Jews is still coming. All of those promises that we've looked at that were in the Abrahamic covenant and in the Davidic covenant and the new covenant are still coming for Israel. Jeremiah 31 is still coming. Now, I say all this, and the reason I emphasize this is because this is fundamental to everything that I will teach when we get to the New Testament. Do you understand that if you understand what I've just said, it not only proves a future for Israel, it also sets the stage for, it doesn't prove, but it certainly sets the stage for understanding the rapture. You understand, no covenant theologian will ever find a rapture in Scripture. They can't. Their system simply will not allow it. If you understand the separation of Israel and the church and this timing and the significance of the 70th week, the rapture becomes not only logical. I think when you come to the New Testament and you compare Scriptures, I think it makes total sense. It's exegetically viable. But you understand, if you don't have this grid, if you don't understand this, the way this works, when you come to the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus spoke about the abomination of desolations as happening just before His return, if you don't understand that He's talking there about the Jews, you're going to get confused. And that's what happens. If you don't believe in the distinction between Israel and the church, you have to make everything in that Olivet Discourse mean the Jews. I mean, the church. And of course you can't have then a pre-tribulation rapture because you have God's people there. But what if those people are the Jews? The Jews spoken of here in the 70th week at the abomination of desolation. Then stuff works out. If you don't have that, you just get confused. That's why all these guys bounce around from opinion to opinion. It doesn't make sense. Now you go to the book of Revelation, and when you understand that the book of Revelation is merely an expansion of this week, and the numbers are all there, you can show it. Okay, the numbers are there. The numbers are given in days, months, and years. So that you have a period from Revelation 6 to Revelation 19, and that is an expansion of this week. It's describing this 7 years, what Jeremiah called Jacob's trouble. And everything works. Now, I'm not saying there are problems. Sure, there are problems. There are things we don't understand. There are things I can't explain. But the timing, it's perfect. Everything works. If you go back, if you look at Revelation 12, it talks about Israel being persecuted by Satan. And it gives the time. 3.5 years. That's exactly what Daniel said. That's the Jews. That's Israel. Now, where am I at here? Any questions about what I've said? Yes.
So we've been
at 69 weeks for 2,000 years? Yes. And that is the greatest point of contention. Yes. No, the 70th week is a literal time period. It's simply that there is a gap between the two. The 70th week is 7 literal years. And by the way, that's one reason that all the amillennialists, in fact, this is one reason they don't glory in the first 69. I'm going to show you why I believe that it came out to the day, to the triumphal entry. The amillennialists will not say that. And they don't even like to talk that way. They like to downplay that. And the reason is because if you suggest that it's a literal 69 times 7 years and it works out, guess what? The 70th year, exegetically, has to be 7 literal years. That's a problem for them. So they love to glory in that kind of this vague talk about numbers where it's just, well, it doesn't really mean the numbers. And you know, they actually, again, if you hear them talk and read, you know, I read their literature, they talk down to people like me as if I was a 4-year-old. I'm not exaggerating. Maybe a little bit. But if you read their literature, you know what I'm talking about. They will talk of, they're the, you know, we just haven't gotten there yet. We haven't arrived. But they have no answer for this. But no, you're right. There is a gap. And that is the big debate. What they will always say is that dispensationalists put the gap in. And I would say, no, the gap is in the text. The gap is demanded by the book of Revelation. It's demanded. But it's in the text. Because there are things that happen between the 69th and 70th year that are much more than 7 years. I mean, no matter how you do it, it just doesn't work. So there is, yes.
The gap is filled by the church age and the gospel because God was doing a new thing.
Yes.
So it was such a revelation for men like Peter and others where this gospel is going to the Gentiles.
Exactly.
Because the prophecies in Jeremiah and Daniel were all with Israel in mind.
Yes.
It was like they couldn't comprehend.
Yes.
The gospel age.
They didn't see it.
They didn't see it. It wasn't for them.
It was hidden. That's why I said earlier this is such a brilliant thing on God's part, because it actually had the Jews looking for the Messiah and a kingdom at the time of His first coming. But it actually took into account their rejection for a time. And the beauty, remember when Jesus in Luke, and we'll look at it, but remember Jesus in Luke 21, He was talking about, He's told the disciples, He said the time is coming when they will surround this city. They will destroy this city. And He said, until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. That's the time we're in. And see, that's the time that's talking about in Daniel. All the nation, we're still in the time of the nations when the kingdoms of this world are still ruling. The kingdoms of this world are still the kingdoms of this world. They're still in charge here from a human perspective. And it will be so until that day when Christ returns and destroys the little horn, brings an end to the transgression of the abomination of desolations, and sets up His kingdom, and, as we saw in Ezekiel last week, enters His temple and sanctifies it. Now, yes?
It's interesting that God had John write the book of Revelation in the period of the gap.
Yes.
To describe a seven-year period that's to come.
Yes. No, that's very true. And honestly, I think that's one of the problems that, again, for lack of a better term, non-dispensationalists have with the book of Revelation, no matter where you put it. I mean, people try to date the book of Revelation here and there. It doesn't matter where you put it. It doesn't fall in the 70th week. It's written long after Christ came, long after He was crucified, long after He's gone. It doesn't work with the 70 weeks. Because it's obviously everything that's in there is still future as of the time of the writing of the book of Revelation. So it doesn't work. Yeah.
Also answer the question where the disciples, when they ask Christ, are you going to be setting up your kingdom? We tend to think of it from the standpoint of
yes.
Today where we said, well, they wanted to replace Rome. We think that's not what we're asking. Because they knew their Bible well enough to
yes.
Know these prophecies. They knew that it wasn't replacing Rome. They knew it was replacing
yes.
Everything throughout the whole earth.
Yes.
And that's what they were looking for, because they did know their eschatology.
Absolutely.
They just didn't see the work.
They could not see the 2,000 years between the cross and His second coming.
Right.
And that's what is telescoped in the Old Testament that comes out in the New Testament that they couldn't see. And it's also, well, go ahead, Gary. It's the time that God has rejected Israel.
So you are equating it to the church?
Yes. In other words, and this is, again, this is what Paul talks about in Romans 11. Again, I've read these passages. I'll read them again and again because I want you to see it. It all works with the New Testament. There's nothing in the New Testament that negates this. It all works perfectly with the New Testament. Romans 11, Paul says, He says, regarding Israel, in the future, I'm going to send a deliverer and remove iniquity from Zion so that all Israel will be saved. He's referring to all the Old Testament prophets. He's saying it's going to happen. It's still coming. That kingdom is coming. Nancy.
I don't understand terms.
That's okay.
Where
They're not exactly the same, but they're, many covenant theologians would be amillennialists. It would be the normal. And just to set the terms without going into all the detail, covenant theologian generally follows, again, Augustine, Calvin, Puritans. Now, technically, Augustine and Calvin weren't covenant theologians, technically, but it's rooted in their theology. And the idea of covenant theology is basically this, that there is, and this is their foundation, really, that there is simply one people of God. And that's it. It had different phases. In other words, Israel was the people of God in the Old Testament. The church is the covenant people now. But generally speaking, all who are saved from beginning to end of history are all one people of God. There's no distinction. They're all saved the same way, which is true. They are. But they would say it's under the covenant of grace, of which we have no record in the Bible. There is no covenant of grace in Scripture. But the idea is, actually, I'm not opposed to that concept in and of itself. It just oversimplifies the text. In other words, could put it this way. Whoever saved from Adam to the end are all going to be saved by faith in God's Word. Their sins will be atoned for by, or have been atoned for by, the blood of Christ. Okay, I agree with that. Okay, there is no other way of salvation. There's only one way of salvation in the Bible. Now, what covenant theologians do is simply say, that's it. End of story. And they simply say there is no distinction between Israel and the church in God's program. And I say that's far too simplistic with the text. So they read that covenant back into everything. And they just run roughshod over whole texts, long texts, and just say, well, that doesn't matter. They read their theology back into the text. And they accuse us of doing the same thing, but I'm just taking the text as it comes. I'm just trying to exegete the text. And when it comes out naturally, it comes out. These numbers work out. You have to, though, maintain that distinction between Israel and the church, or it doesn't work. You will get confused.
The Abrahamic covenant was given to a Gentile.
Technically. I mean, before that, there really wasn't any distinction. But, I mean, again, you're looking at the sovereignty of God. So, you know, when we get to the New Testament, and this is why I've emphasized this, we're going to look back at these things. When we get to Christ's Olivet Discourse, we're going to bring up Daniel 9, because that's where the abomination of desolations is talked about, that he's talking about. When we get to 2 Thessalonians 2, and it talks about the man of sin, we're going to come back to Daniel, because that's where it's talked about. It's the little horn. When we get to the book of Revelation, and we're going to look at how the book of Revelation works, we're going to come back to Daniel, because that's how it works. You can't understand it apart from understanding Daniel. And you can't understand Daniel unless you understand the kingdom he's talking about in the context of the Old Testament. It's so clear. The Scriptures are repeated over and over again. The information in the Old Testament regarding the kingdom is so overwhelming and irrefutable that when you understand that, when you see that, everything in the New Testament fits in with that. If you lose sight of that distinction between the church and Israel, it doesn't work. I mean, it's confusing. And these guys, most of them have very little conviction about eschatology other than the fact that they know they don't believe in dispensationalism. I'm serious. That's the one conviction they have. They don't want to be a dispensationalist. And I'll tell you why. And I'm not oversimplifying. It's intellectual suicide. I'm just serious. It's intellectual suicide. There are a lot of analogies between the evolutionist and intelligent design debate. You know, the big movie out right now is Expelled. And that's the kind of thing that goes on, maybe not to that extreme. But there is that kind of looking down on. If you're a dispensationalist and you believe that there's a future for Israel and a Jewish kingdom coming, you are looked down upon as just above an idiot in intellectual circles. And I'm not, maybe a little exaggeration, but not totally. It's just not intellectually acceptable. But I'm really not interested in what's intellectually acceptable. I really want to be true to the book. And the book is clear. When you study these things out, the book is clear. And whenever you talk to these things about Reformed people, oftentimes their response is something like, eschatology isn't important. And I say, what? Not important? All of the scriptures that talk about it, and you're going to tell me it's not important? We shouldn't try to figure it out? We shouldn't try to talk about it? It's not important? It's what we're looking for. We're looking for the return of Christ. We ought to glory in what God has revealed in relation to the end. And we ought to search it out. And truly, that is a lot of my purpose in doing this, is to give you an understanding and a desire to understand these things, because it is important. We ought to be excited about the Lord's return. Any other things before we close? Yes, Troy. Yeah, I think that's what it's talking. I think what he's talking about there is the fact that when he was cut off, that is when he was crucified, and I think this is Isaiah 53, basically. When he was crucified, from a human perspective, it seemed like he attained nothing. I think it's referring to the fact that he didn't receive the kingdom. That everything that was promised in the Old Testament regarding the Messiah, he did not receive. He was cut off and didn't obtain the kingdom. I mean, from a standpoint of time. I think that's what it's referring to. That he seemed like a failure from human perspective. Yes. Well, there is a great deal of discussion about, is Christ ruling now on the Davidic throne? That's what a lot of covenant theologians would say, that Christ is ruling now on the Davidic throne at the right hand of the Father. And they would argue that that's a fulfillment of these promises of reigning on David's throne. And my simple response to that is, nowhere is that called David's throne. Nowhere is it seen as a fulfillment of the Old Testament. What it is seen in the book of Acts, when you look at the text, and what oftentimes people point to as saying this proves David he reigning on David's throne, it's all it's saying is that he's the one that God promised would reign on David's throne. It's simply saying this is the Messiah. This is the one who would fulfill it. But if you look at Psalm 110, you'll notice that it says that he said unto my... just turn there real quick. In Psalm 110... which is talking about the Messiah, he said, the Lord, that is Yahweh, said to my Lord, that is the Messiah, sit at my right hand, which is where he is now, by the way. That's where he is now. He's at the right hand of the Father. So the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. What's the word? The next word? Until. And that's where he's at now. Until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. That's when the kingdom comes. That's Psalm 2. When he comes down and he rules with a rod of iron. He is at the right hand of the Father right now waiting. He's not reigning now. Yes, it's true, and I think we can say spiritually that Christ is reigning in our hearts and he's reigning over the church. Sure, I don't have a problem with that language. But he's not reigning on David's throne and he's not fulfilling the kingdom of the Old Testament. That's a totally different thing. The Bible is very exact. The language is very exact. And what these guys do in the Old Testament is they run roughshod over the language. They ignore it. They ignore the text. They ignore the context. And they simply say fulfilled in Christ. They cannot do what I did in the last year, and that is take you detail for detail through the Old Testament exegesis. They can't. They won't. They refuse to. I've never heard anyone do it. I've never seen them respond to these things. I've never seen it. They simply can't. They have to spiritualize. They have to say this doesn't mean what it says. And that's why it's it's such a point of contention, and it is a point of contention. Well, that's a very good question, and one of the arguments, again, of the amillennialists today in regard to this is they say, historically, no one's ever seen a gap. Actually, that's not true. I was just reading this week. I didn't know this before. There were several in historical theology of the early church fathers who believed that the 70th week was just before Christ's return in the future and that there was a gap, including Irenaeus in Against Heresies, which was one of the famous church fathers. And his disciple, who I think was Hippolytus or some name like that. I'm not an expert on the church fathers. But there were several. In fact, a reform guy about 50 years ago wrote an article in Westminster Theological Journal about the historical understanding of this text in Daniel 9. And he says basically in that article that it was split between two main ideas. One is that it was already fulfilled, and one that there was a gap and it was future. So, no, it's not a new idea. And what changed it was Augustine. It was through Augustine and Jerome that amillennialism came into the fore, and the idea of a future kingdom was seen as heretical. I mean, that's when it changed. It changed with Augustine, and everyone follows Augustine. And these guys will go out of their way to line up with Augustine and Calvin. They'll do anything it takes to line up with those two. And you know, they're good men, great men, but they weren't perfect. So, any other questions? All right. Dave, could I just ask you to close us in a word of prayer?